Receiving this message. We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
Have accessed entry 145.1T0515, certificate number 38501. Bothered about Dungeons and Dragons.
So, what is the DC?
The DC is 10 plus my power stat, so 13.
Okay, well, that will pass. The ooze squishes away from it.
Okay, so the ooze will be green.
And the flying creature flies into it.
Okay, so 6 to the flying creature, and I'll give you the half number, 2 to the ooze.
Okay. This just turns into a puddle of goo.
Nice.
What's your...
This is definitely the first show that's also a Dear Abby correspondent.
Actually, it's my Twitch name. what's your first-hand experience with demons, Ken? Do demons play a role in the Mormon cosmology?
Very, very little, actually. Mm-hmm. Like, there's not a lot of the evangelical style, well, you know what, if you do X, if you listen to rock and roll, the demons will come into your room through the...
They get inside you,
the
right?
Jungle rhythms or the heavy metal lyrics or the backwards...
It's the jungle rhythms.
The backwards secret messages. And there's also very little kinds of... there's very little lore about demonic possession and exorcism and that kind of thing. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, teenage boys don't love to whisper about that kind of thing in any suburb,
right?
Secular or not. But it's not a huge part of my upbringing. Like, well, make sure the demons don't get you as I'm strapping up my backpack for school.
Or as you're laying your head down on your pillow.
Don't let the bed bugs bite.
So you don't have any firsthand, you ever encounter a demon or ever feel like
think so.
There's but, a demon on your shoulder?
Again, like, I feel like if you hang out with young people in the Latter-day Saint community, just like evangelicals or maybe even Catholics, there might be some, you know what I heard my cousin saw once.
I believe the Catholics are also... Catholic boys are also doing this, yes.
Probably,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, that's why they get chosen for the exorcist. You don't want a Lutheran guy up in there.
Well, that's what's causing them to masturbate so furiously.
Like, you know, it'll be like, man, my cousin said, you know, he went into this house and there was like a really bad feeling and, you know, and there was like a really feeling of darkness in the corner and he had to say a prayer or whatever. But like in church, like actual theology...
You're not
going to hear that. And I've never had that kind of, like I've walked into houses that had a bad feeling, but it was because there was like a rat in the wall or,
right. Or it was just a bummer house.
Yeah. Like the feng shui was bad or, you know, some lousy out of work dad wasn't cleaning up or.
No, wait, have we ever talked about this? Do you believe in ghosts?
I think we have talked about this literally every show.
Yeah, I guess so.
Why does every omnibus begin with you asking me if I believe in ghosts?
Do you believe in ghosts?
Stop bullying me.
No, it's because I'm a ghost this whole time.
Oh my gosh.
This whole time you thought that you could see dead people and it was me.
Ghost dad. I don't know. No,
yeah, sort of,
probably.
Maybe?
I don't think so, actually. They appear to not have, you know, I'm hopeful for an afterlife. But it doesn't seem like they hang out much.
Do you get spooked? Well, that's a better question. Do you get spooked?
I get spooked by scary movies. If I have to like walk back upstairs to bed in the dark.
You're spooked if you were watching a scary movie?
Yeah, a little bit.
What if you were walking through the Vermont hinterlands in the middle of the night and had to cross a graveyard? And it was foggy.
I think I would enjoy that. I'd be like, boy, when does this kind of thing happen?
It's
like,
pretty exciting.
I'm going to get my, this is going to be good for TikTok.
But not spooked. Yeah, a little spooked. Depending on how many scary movies.
I find graveyards very peaceful. Yeah. Like, do you, this sounds like a very specific story, possibly one I've heard before. I'm not sure.
Oh, there was one time I was hitchhiking in Vermont. And
didn't you stay with somebody creepy? I've heard this story. No, that's in Europe.
No, that was in Vermont too. Oh. Different time. Vermont's a very spooky state.
Why is Vermont the Transylvania of New England?
Freaking spooky there.
But very vaccinated. Good
job. It's super vaccinated. Good job, Vermont. It's super liberal, like all ghostly places.
Do you think the COVID vaccine maybe, lets people see ghosts?
This happened a long time before then. No, I was hitchhiking and the guy I was riding with, for whatever reason, came to a crossroads and he was like, you got to get out here. And I got out and it was across the street from an insane asylum, which inexplicably was still open in Vermont after they'd been closed everywhere else. And I think the sign literally said insane asylum.
Wouldn't a closed, dilapidated one be worse? I'd be happy to see a cheery, well-lit sanitarium.
Well, but it was like up a driveway, up on top of a hill. And so I was like, oh, I don't want to.
Is there lightning flashing behind it?
Sort of. And so I stood out in front of it hitchhiking, and a few cars went by, and as they saw me, they accelerated, right? So I was like, oh, I can't stay here.
Well, you were wearing a hospital gown, confusingly.
In homage to Kurt Cobain at the Reading Festival. And I said, I got to get out of here. So I left and started walking up the street, but it was so headless horseman-y out there, foggy and hills and stuff. I was like, I started to get really spooked by headless horsemen. And then I cut across I was like, oh, a field. And I cut across it. And then I'm in the middle of one of those Vermont-y graveyards where all the stones are like falling down. Yeah. And there's stones with angels carved in them and all this Revolutionary War creepiness. And I started to really lose my cool.
Somebody was watching you in some lab doing some cabin in the woods thing to you, like, all right, now let's see what he thinks of the graveyard, and he's amping up the subsonics.
So I started to like really kind of, not panic exactly, but I was like, get me out of this graveyard. And I got out of the graveyard somewhere else and stuck out my thumb, and some guy in a pickup truck picked me up, and he was a super creep. And the whole thing was just like, what am I doing here? But then it ended up loving Vermont.
Look how you're here and did not get killed by a chainsaw.
Yeah.
In summary, come to beautiful Vermont. Explore beautiful Vermont.
So I did stay in a house in Vermont many, many years later, and it did have a terrible ghost in it, but we'll save that for a different show.
Or a past one.
Or a past show.
I think we've talked about
it before. We'll talk about it a lot. We'll keep talking about it. It'll come up. But Satanism, you know, it has a long, or I'm sorry, fear of demons has a long, long history in human life.
Because demons used to get the blame for all our ills, right?
Yeah. Well, come and go. Demons come and go.
But I'm serious. If, you know, somebody who got somebody who's got a skin condition or is, you know, bonked their head and is babbling, like, you know, nowadays you wouldn't say, I mean, unless you live in a certain part of the country, you wouldn't say, man, demons, but...
Yeah, but it's, you know, that's all sort of depending on what Christianity is doing in your neighborhood at the time. You know, that there have been times when people were burned at the stake for demonic possession, and really what it was they were criticizing the government.
There's some traditions that are not purely European too, right? Like in, you know, 13th century China, I wouldn't be surprised if
demons would, the government.
Yeah. Or demons get a tree falls over on your shed and demons get the blame, or, you know, you start to lose your hair and demons get the blame.
Oh yeah. There are demons and djinns and bears. Oh my, throughout history.
Demons are a global presence.
Yes, they are. Yes. And that's why I invested all my Bitcoin in Demons Inc. Demons.io. But in America, you know, famously Salem witch trials were kind of a hysteria. A lot of the hysteria around demons kind of was part of the great Jewish libel or the anti-Semitic libel that we talked about in the Elders of Zion episode.
What connection gets made between anti-Semitism and demonic possession?
Oh, just that the Jews were using blood, you know, Christian blood in their rites, and you know, that they are themselves
got some
demonic.
Yeah, they're the only people in your town that might be doing some terrible magic against you.
Right.
If you live in 15th century Poland or something.
Yeah, magic being a thing that is anti-Christian.
Sure.
But you know, in the United States, it has a demonic possession wends its way through the American story.
We should say we don't endorse these beliefs. Your Jewish neighbors are not making a golem with your with Chex Mix on them.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not. And but we've done shows about new religious movements, new spiritual movements, particularly in the 19th century in America, that in many ways kind of trended toward spiritualism, trended toward magic and the afterlife.
Ghosts and the occult.
But in a kind of, you know, positive or curious way. And then there's a...
Maybe even a scientific way.
A scientific way, right.
This is how we're going to sense ghosts with this thingy.
And then there's a, you know, a slip back into tent revivalism that often is, you know, posits itself as a counter, you know, a new return to the, you know, traditional brick and mortar Christianity, or in this case, tent and stake Christianity.
But in all these times, there's been one constant: demons.
Demons.
Demons have been one constant through the years. America's rolled by like an army of steamrollers, Ray.
I was very conscious of demons growing up because I was, well, for most of my teen years and 20s, I was demon adjacent.
You were listening to
Taboo Rhythms.
You were listening to AC/DC. Of course, the demons were in your bedroom.
But in the 1970s, when I was a young boy, and here's another story that really begins in the 70s and really comes to fruition in the 80s, like all of the great episodes of Omnibus. In the early 70s, there was a kind of a real blooming of interest in and fear of the occult and the supernatural. And it was really a perfect storm, I guess, of a lot of this kind of disparate things all kind of happening at once and sort of pointing at a supernatural world that we did need to direct science at, but also it became a social problem, or it became a social concern.
Well, how does this chronologically line up with what we now look back on as kind of the rise of the moral majority, religious America as a politically aligned, you know, as a voting bloc, basically? Is this the same exact same time period?
The moral majority is the result of, or rather, the moral majority was kind of founded in the first big like heat wave of response to what was a late 60s origin story around Manson and Anton LaVey starting the Church of Satan, and a kind of feeling in the air that...
So it is the hippies' fault, this whole thing.
Again, it's the boomers that did it. A feeling that, you know, a lot of churches, a lot of so evangelicalism in America is... You know, an extension of that tent revival thing, and they were, tilting against rock and roll from the very beginning, and the feeling that rock and roll was using African American music to corrupt the youth, and that's
how communism's going to get.
That's
here.
Right, and ultimately anti-Christian. But like LaVey formed the Church of Satan in 1966, and.
I mean, if you don't want people to accuse you of being a Satanist, Anton LaVey, don't start the Church of Satan.
I mean,
in
1966. Don't have your name be Anton LaVey, a very satanic name. And LaVey was just, you know, in my estimation, just goofing. His book,
he's trolling,
and he's having a good time. He writes the Satanic Bible. It's really just a bunch of, hoo ha and self help. Texts, you know, it's a compilation,
and to
really.
And to this day, that's what the Church of Satan is, right? Like, oh, the name's just there to scare the normies.
Yeah.
We don't even believe in Satan. We're a bunch of you know, progressive atheist free thinkers, right?
It's pretty cosplay-y.
Yeah.
And it's coming up in a time when biker gangs are terrorizing the small towns of Southern California. You know, it's just part of a zeitgeist, an anti-authoritarian, anti-culture zeitgeist. But Manson puts a scare into it, right? Manson is... Manson makes Satanism look bad, for lack of a better term. You know, he converts it into murder.
And I guess that brings it home. Like, that could have been your neighbor's house, you know, yeah. Like people in your community. Like, this was just some regular house in the Hollywood Hills, and look what happened.
Look what happened. And then in 1973, the movie The Exorcist came out. And that was an extremely popular movie in its time. And it put... You know, it lodged in the collective conscious an image of satanic possession that was visceral and terrifying.
And this will surprise, you know, 21st century listeners or thereafter. Like a movie like The Exorcist could be an R-rated kind of for adults serious drama. Could be the biggest movie in America. The Exorcist was the top grossing movie of 1973 by a mile ahead of, and the rest of the thing looks crazy too. The Sting and American Graffiti. And it's all this dad stuff. You have to get down to six or seven before you get to a Clint Eastwood or a James Bond movie. Paper Moon made almost as much money as Live and Let Die.
I mean, it was a huge phenomenon.
It was a mega phenomenon. And even in our horror loving era, this was mass culture in a way that Gen X and below cannot concede.
And people really dug it. You know, they dug the scare. They dug the horror, right? And it was not a slasher movie. It was a psychological film.
And it wasn't a fun chiller in the way that the horror movies that people would have grown up with up till now. You weren't like, ooh, my nerves are all a tingle after Frankenstein and Dracula came into the lab together. It really is like, I'm kind of discouraged and alienated now after The Exorcist,
and it was playing on other things that were in the culture at the time. In the late 60s, there was also a new expression of the new religious movement. Right, there was we were seeing Indian or quasi Indian religions kind of brought in, and New Age cults. The Beatles and the Maharishi, the hippie return to the land movement, and all of it kind of combined to sort of scare the public into feeling like this generation of young boomers was out having ritual sex and disbelieving in traditional God.
If you don't know much about the stuff, it's easy for it all to coalesce in your head as one single boogeyman.
Right.
Like this is like it, today it's easy to kind of see the multiple influences that were going on. But if you're a crew-cutted dad in 1970, this all looks like a singular assault.
It does. And throughout the 70s, there was, you know, and then we've talked many times on the Omnibus about the corresponding rise in belief in UFOs and in the Bermuda Triangle and in Bigfoot. It was a credulous time. But by the late 70s, it had combined with some other influences, including the rise of the anti-cult movement. And the anti-cult movement had two hemispheres that we see a lot of parallels in this today. On the conservative side, there was the Christian counter-cult movement, where there started to be an interest in, taking these forlorn and wayward young Christian kids that had gone off and started believing in, you know, not Ramtha, but proto-Ramtha.
Yeah, taking the waifs out of the UFO cults and the biker gangs and
right.
Brainwashing them back to Jesus.
But on the other hand, there was on the kind of psychological left side of the equation, a growing belief in brainwashing and in de-cultifying people by returning them to rationality.
So from even, Christian influenced religious training.
Right.
Some of those people would need deprogramming as well.
That's right. And Christian cults being something that they, that the anti-brainwashing.
I'd like to think I would have been part of the sensible middle in that period. I would have been just in favor of deprogramming everyone,
mm-hmm.
deprogramming from the left everyone. And the right.
And what's interesting is that, and we don't think about this as much as maybe we should in these terms, but social work as a science and as a practical profession, only really coalesced in the 1970s. You know, there'd always been social work in a Christian
way. I'm imagining way. Salvation Army soup kitchens.
Yeah, a lot of that, you know, orphans, and then the mental, mental hospitals, doctors of psychiatry and psychology. But it was only in the late 60s and 70s that social work as a discipline and a government agency, and this kind of went along with the deinstitutionalization, the closing of the asylums, and social work had all of these elements, the child welfare and poverty and trauma was a kind of new idea, right? Like post-traumatic stress disorder was only defined really and called that in 1978. And it was,
even though a whole generation had shell shock from World War I or whatever.
Right. And that was, shell shock. And it was kind of thought of as like a moral weakness.
Yeah.
And PTSD was first described in an Air Force study because the Air Force had sent a response team to Jonestown after the massacre there.
Oh.
And, you know, the Air Force, the airmen that arrived in Jonestown to, deal with all the bodies, you know, hundreds of dead people and a lot of children. And those bodies had been sitting out in tropical air for 3 days.
Yeah.
So the whole experience of processing that crime scene, affected these airmen to a degree that the Air Force was like, we need to, you know, commission a study. And post-traumatic stress disorder.
This is the Air Force. They'd been seeing flying saucers for decades.
Well, and they'd also had all of Vietnam. I mean, all these guys that were back from Vietnam, they'd been back for 10 years in a lot of cases.
But it was like a post-Manson style cult that really moved the needle.
Yeah. And I think in the 1980s and 90s even, I remember the PTSD diagnosis being gradually extended to include Vietnam vets, because for a lot of that time, it was still controversial.
I think I just would have assumed it was a post-Vietnam thing. That's fascinating.
Yeah. And it was, so this is all part of like a rise in social work and in what was, I think even then called the mental health consumer movement, where mental health started to become a thing where we thought of, where the business aspect of medicine started to think of the sick as consumers of their product, the medical product.
We need some new pills for them. We need them all in therapy.
And this, and this was the beginning of the survivor movement, survivors of abuse and so forth. A recognition that they were, you could think of them as a collective consumers of mental health problems.
And that's trauma product. As well, yeah.
Yeah. The thing about the rise of social work is that the initial desire to have child abuse even recognized as a thing.
Right. And not just, he's not a very good dad, but that's their house.
Right. That's their house. Exactly. And so in the 1970s, a big part of the dawn of social work as a kind of agency was to, to deal with child abuse survivors or children that were being abused, and just to raise the public consciousness.
Educate people that this is a social ill.
Yeah, this is real.
Yeah.
And so we arrive at the very late 70s, and that's when Jerry Falwell in 1979 forms the Moral Majority. And it's, and you remember it, I'm sure. I remember it very clearly. The sudden kind of new energy that was in evangelical Christianity, and it was, and this is, just preceding the election of Ronald Reagan, a real feeling that we had lost our way, that the America was full of Satanists and
feminists,
feminists and civil rights leaders, and they needed to all be, you know, put back under the tent of mainstream Christianity, or at the time, radical Christianity.
Like at the time, mainstream Christian attitudes towards socialists were not what we would expect today. You know, there were not anti-abortion planks for a lot of Protestant organizations, and both political parties supported the ERA. I mean, it was really like Falwell and his generation kind of creating a movement saying, we're going to redefine American Christianity to be this. And it's a certain kind of social policy.
Yeah, it was an era of real mellowing in mainstream Christianity. There was a lot more kumbaya. The Catholic Church had had Vatican II a dozen years before and were, you know, liberalizing. And so, yeah, this was...
Jerry had it up to here.
He had.
With folk songs around the campfire.
And another element, in addition to global communism, was that the late 60s and mid-70s were also, mid to late 70s, were also a period where there were suddenly very visible serial killers who were taunting the press. There was the Zodiac Killer, there was Bundy, there was Gacy.
This is all post-Manson kind of escalation and imitation, right?
Yeah, Son of Sam, and then in Washington, the Green River Killer. Well, actually, a lot of these are in Washington.
we're hitting above our weight.
And the pan, you know, if you think about the Son of Sam panic in New York in the late 70s, just the sense that there was some killer that was, you know, like waiting for you when you came home at night.
And it was an epical summer defining thing. Every day it would be like, hey, what's the latest headline in the Post? You know, like
right.
that's kind of the only thing that's going on in the biggest city in the world.
Yeah. Pretty exciting. Right. Well, let's go back a little bit to the late 60s during this heady and exciting time. In this period, there was, also a rise in the popularity, and believe me, in the late 60s, it was not yet mainstream at all. It was a very gradual and very fringe rise, kind of like the rise of wife swapping, but this was board gaming.
Oh, even worse.
And traditionally, like war gaming, as a hobby, yeah, was about moving armies around, right? You were Napoleon and you know, and here came the British or here came the Russians.
We've reminisced about these kind of bookshelf games for bookish types who would have, you know, 27 day long
right
reenactments of the Psalm or whatever it is.
Yeah, the, you know, Risk. I mean, you're playing these global kind of games.
But it was really the first time people would insert their head into a game, you know, in a way that wouldn't happen if you were playing a buddy chess by mail or something. And in a pre-video game era, you know, it was hard for people to imagine that you would just kind of insert your consciousness into a gaming world for weeks on end.
And the interesting transition that happened in the late 60s was the rise of the very first war games where they were actually role-playing, where you weren't moving armies around, that you could actually personify yourself in the game as a single character and enter into a campaign and have a personality.
Except I've been playing Monopoly that way for years.
Yeah, right.
Oh boy, that's my hotel.
You're like, I'm a shoe.
I'm Mr. how did a shoe get ahead in this town and buy a hotel? I don't know.
I've always been a shoe in my heart.
I'm a big thimble. Give me your money.
But let's talk about a man that we've discussed on the show before a little bit. And this comes up over and over, and I think it partly comes up in the Omnibus because it has a lot of contemporary analogs, and I think you and I both are kind of fascinated by it. And this history is still alive. I mean, it's all this is happening within my lifetime. And I think when futurelings look back at this era, late 20th century, early 21st century, they're going to think of it as the role-playing, you know, it'll be the furries that come to dominate.
You were born in the 70s? Did you know Gary Gygax?
And that's who we're talking about. Gary Gygax, who was a Chicago-born gamer, you know, fascinating gamer guy. And Gygax is a very interesting product of his time. Not quite an Asimov, not quite a Heinlein, but
was reading those guys, yeah, for sure.
And definitely like a kind of big personality. Gygax was a gamer, and he started Gen Con, the original kind of like board game conference, and the granddaddy or grandmommy of all the subsequent cons, Comic-Con and Dragon Con.
He creates con culture pretty much.
He does.
And it's for what? It's for college kids and greatest generation dads who like playing
war games.
Battleship games?
Yeah, yeah, war gaming and so forth. And everybody gets together in the Midwest in, you know, now it's in Indianapolis, but it was
just some roadside Ramada somewhere.
Yeah, it was in Wisconsin. It was in Wisconsin for a long time. And Gygax actually moved to Wisconsin to a town called Lake Geneva, where he lived the rest of his life, except for, you know, he went to Hollywood at one point to make for his big break, but he moved back to Lake Geneva. It's kind of like
he wanted to see Marlon Wayans make the Dungeons and Dragons movie, and you know, who among us wouldn't?
Yeah, it's a little bit like Dave Chappelle living in Yellow Waterfall, Ohio, or wherever it is he lives.
How's that going for him?
I think it keeps him from getting get paint thrown on him in the streets. So Gygax starts Gen Con, and he's working with a couple of other people. He's kind of very influenced by Tolkien, who's also
a counterculture hero now.
And creating this world of demons and supernatural characters.
Mythology's big.
Right. It's all kind of, you know, in this coalescing storm. And Gygax creates a role-playing game, and initially, you know, the basic form of it is a boxed little game like you would buy like Monopoly, called Dungeons and Dragons. And it gradually, you know, Dungeons and Dragons is popular within this small subculture, but only selling, you know, a couple thousand D&D boxes.
He's probably boxing them up in his garage and putting them in the mail or selling 100 at Gen Con every year.
He for sure is. But it's, you know, it's popular within this world, and partly it's part of this new first-person gamer game.
It's just like these military campaigns, except wouldn't it be fun if you could fight the orcs you read about in The Hobbit instead of Nazis or Confederates?
Right. And then in 1977, and 77 is a big year for this.
Star Wars, too.
It's Star Wars, and it's the introduction of Advanced Dungeons & Dragons.
Dungeons and Dragons needed to get advanced for it to catch on.
And Advanced D&D was something that they expected, you know, you'd start with basic D&D, and which was more of a lighthearted, fun thing. And then Advanced D&D, they came out with these books that we've described before.
A lot of structure, a lot of rules. That's the fun of it.
Yeah, it's
the complexity.
Super rule-based, super complex. And then you would evolve, you know, as a game player, you would go to Advanced D&D. And again, it was selling to this target audience of about 3,000 people. How would you describe it? Yeah, it was for the tactical side of the gaming community, less than the like, let's sit down and play Dungeons and Dragons for a couple of hours.
I remember my parents discovering it right around 79 or 80. Is that the moment when the Burbs caught wind of Advanced Dungeons and Dragons?
It is. And we'll see that in a second. Now,
sorry, I jumped ahead.
No, that's all right. That you're exactly, you have given me my entree.
Yeah.
There's another thing that's happening at the same time in the culture, which kind of plays into this story too. In 1977, Clive Barker wrote the book Theater Games.
Ugh.
About improvisational theater as a kind of fun new way of theaterizing. And improv theater has a long history, right, all the way back to medieval times. And it was it in the 50s and 60s was very popular in Chicago and in Toronto as a kind of, you know, the second
Del
city.
Close and second city.
And all of that fed into the popularity of Saturday Night Live, which often felt completely improvised. And by 77, you know, Saturday Night Live was in the, again, enormously popular. And Theater Games became a sort of seminal work, followed in 79 by Keith Johnson's invention of theater sports.
And so the fact that it's Clive Barker means this is where kind of a geek gamer horror audience first discovers the tools of improv comedy, God help us.
Right. Leading to the destruction of civilization. This will be this is the moment.
But this becomes the flavor of D&D gaming then.
Yeah. Right. There's a new energy around improvising.
Not a campaign so much as it is like, it's also like now it's a social thing and it's a skit.
Yeah. And it's cosplaying without the cause.
Yeah. Yeah. My parents were not dressing as wizards.
Are you sure? Didn't you go to bed at a certain time?
We were never allowed to go down into that chain basement.
Yeah. What was your bedtime? It was 9 o'clock. And when did they go to bed?
When are mommy and daddy getting their special robes?
2:30 in the morning. So now we've set the stage. It's 1979.
At this rate, this may be the longest omnibus yet. I guess we did start in medieval times, so yeah, we're doing good.
Yeah, we
started with like Jesus and the lepers. So.
We're going to start accelerating now. In 1979, a Michigan State student by the name of James Dallas Egbert III.
I feel his pain.
James Egbert was kind of socially struggling. He was doing drugs. And this is something that people probably don't remember. But
about computer science majors? That they struggle socially and do drugs?
They did a lot of drugs. And in 1979, 16-year-olds were all on drugs. I don't think that's true now. Right. Now they're all on games.
Now you're just shocked when you watch The Goonies and they say, like, you're like, wait,
yeah,
these are kids. They can't say that.
Yeah. Bad News Bears. I mean, they were having sex and drinking beer.
They were saying the N-word probably. I don't know.
But so James Dallas Egbert having a hard time in college and he was going to summer school at Michigan State. And at a certain point, he wrote a suicide note that he'd had it and it was all over. And when and if they found his body, he wanted it to, you know, he wanted to be set on fire, put in a canoe and set on fire and sent down the river Styx or whatever. I don't remember what the suicide note said.
But he did have some kind of grandiose, possibly mythological suicide note.
It was just a regular suicide note. Oh, okay. And the cops investigating the disappearance, because, you know, he was gone for a couple of days, but then pretty soon he was gone for a week and it became a thing, that the cops kind of needed to direct more attention to. And there was a kind of cryptic poster board in his dorm room that had some stick pins in it that they felt like maybe was a significant clue.
Why are the police trying to solve a suicide?
Well, it's a disappearance.
Oh, this is before the body's found.
Yeah. And this this is a situation where, well, you know, it could be Satan. It could be a lot of things.
They probably didn't start with Satan.
They didn't start with Satan, but it quickly kind of, the evidence pointed to the fact that, the James Egbert did play role-playing games, although was not, you know, there was no account of him being obsessed with it or you know, losing his head. And he also liked the steam tunnels that were under Michigan State University. So, you know, steam tunnels being a...
Anybody would like the steam tunnels under Michigan State University. I mean, if that makes you a Satanist, then I guess, John, I'm a Satanist.
And he did imply in his suicide note that he would be found in the steam tunnels. Now, James Egbert was depressed and was tripping out. And he did take a bunch of Quaaludes and go down into the steam tunnels, hoping to overdose and die, and then have his body found in the steam tunnels, and this would be his 16-year-old glorious end.
But again, I don't hear Satan anywhere in this dissociative story.
He was just a kid that had access to Quaaludes that wanted to die in a steam tunnel. Pretty common. But he woke up from the Quaaludes. He didn't die. He didn't take enough Quaaludes.
Oh, that's why we're having such a merry take on this story. I was kind of wondering. He's still alive.
And
he's with us here today. James, say hi to the folks.
He's not, unfortunately, because, spoiler alerts. But he's embarrassed, and he goes and stays with a friend and says, don't tell anybody that I'm here. His parents feel like the cops are doing a bad job of investigating the disappearance of their son, and they hire a detective by the name of William Deere. And William Deere doesn't have any experience of cults, and these role-playing games are brand new, and so he goes around kind of asking Egbert's friends to describe Dungeons and Dragons, and he puts together a theory that Egbert has gotten obsessed with role-playing games and was going down into the steam tunnels to act out his Dungeons and Dragons campaign.
Makes sense. Dungeon is in the name. He's going into the closest thing to a dungeon that I'm sure Michigan State University has to offer.
It does.
I mean, it's like, I kind of want to be charitable to the kind of alarmed moms we're going to be meeting in this story, because I have teenagers myself, and often you're at wit's end.
You're an alarmed mom in a lot of these cases.
I'm an alarmed mom pretty much all the time. And there, I do understand the temptation to kind of blame the new thing you don't understand, Like, when I found out, my teens were like knew all these people on social media or whatever, I was like, wait, I wasn't talking to strangers from Mexico when I was that age.
Wait a minute. Didn't you do a Mormon mission in Mexico?
Spain.
Well,
but not
the Mexico of Europe.
Not when I was 14. I think Portugal's in Mexico. Not when I was 14, but you know what I mean? I never played this many hours of video games a day. And now my teen is like hollow eyed and, doesn't like talking to me. No, your teen is hollow eyed and doesn't like talking to you because
they're on Quaaludes.
Well, cause they're 15, But it's easy to make it Minecraft's fault or whatever the thing is you didn't have.
Well, like I say, leading up to this moment, culturally, there are probably 50 vectors pointing at the total plausibility that a kid would get involved in fantasy gaming, become obsessed with it, in combination with drugs, start acting out his crazy fantasies, and also be susceptible to cults, demonic possession, which may or may not be real. And Jerry Falwell and the Moral Majority really wanted demonic possession to be real. It powered a lot of their...
You can literally demonize your opponents if there are demons responsible for... now that there's gays in the schools or whatever Jerry Falwell is mad about.
And also on the other side, on the science and liberal mental health side, there's a lot of energy around mental illness and schizophrenia.
Yeah.
And also,
you've got the languages of religion and science to kind of alarm you here.
So it is kind of conceivable in this moment, and particularly James Egbert being a kind of brilliant boy, that his parents would seek an explanation greater than that he just, and particularly that he left a suicide note, went into the steam tunnels, and then could not be found. Yeah. And William Deere made a big show of going down and searching the steam tunnels again and again, and he publicized this. He was kind of initially a showman.
Yeah.
Now, again, a spoiler alert, it turns out that after many, 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 many years of investigation into the role that Dungeons and Dragons and role-playing games played in...
The role that role-playing played, Deli.
The science seems to indicate that, in fact, role players and gamers have a much lower rate of suicide, that in almost no instance do Dungeons and Dragons players or role-playing gamers ever actually go out and play
with a mace?
Yeah, I mean, there is the the creative anachronism people, there is a culture.
There's LARPing.
Of LARPing, but it's not really connected to gaming. It's like none of the panic around, well, none of the satanic panic.
No element of it was fact-based.
None of it ever, none of it stands up to scrutiny, right? Throughout the entire satanic panic era, there were over 12,000 instances where Satanism, like someone was accused of satanic ritual, and in the of the 12,000, zero of them were ever demonstrated by evidence to have, there are no satanic sex cults.
Young people are just too lazy
yeah.
to get velvet robes and a stone altar and carve occult symbols in them.
Yeah, nobody follows through on this. If you want to kill somebody, you just go kill them, right? Or, I mean, I don't know. It's
even Anton LaVey is just saying he's a Satanist, yeah. but he doesn't have time for all of that.
Yeah,
this that Aleister Crowley stuff, what a drag.
This is hard work, right? Satanism. Yeah. Anyway, James Egbert is now in the newspaper every day. He's like cowering in his friend's apartment in East Lansing, Michigan. And he kind of, his friend kicks him out and he goes to some other friend. Everywhere he goes, he's making people promise, don't tell anybody.
What's the time frame here? Is he gone for like days or weeks?
He's gone for weeks. William Deere is, I mean, the story now becomes a national news story. This kid is playing this strange new game, Dungeons and Dragons. He got lost in an actual dungeon.
So this is before the game has actually arrived at most people's attention in other ways. This is the first way a lot of people are hearing of
it? So this is 1979. This is when your parents got it, because in the space between the disappearance of James Egbert and when he was found, sales of Dungeons and Dragons went from 3,000 a year to 30,000 a year, and then 30,000 a month.
So next time I have a book out, yeah. I need to make sure some kid reads my book, stoned out of his head on mushrooms, and wanders into the woods.
Right. And then have it be connected to your weird, creepy theories about maps or whatever it is you're yeah. your nearest book about.
Probably.
Eventually, James Egbert hitchhikes to Louisiana.
Whoa.
And starts to try and live down there. He got a job as a, you know, sweeping floors. He got a job.
He's probably followed the news cycles about him.
Yeah. Oh, no. It's in the newspapers everywhere. And eventually starts to feel bad. He's only 16. He probably misses his mom. And he calls William Deere, announces that he's alive and in Louisiana. Deere drives down there to pick him up. And Egbert makes Deere promise that he won't reveal that he was just...
goofing.
Well, no, not a goof. I mean, he tried to commit suicide and failed and then was embarrassed and then went to Louisiana.
Oh, I see.
He was just like, don't tell any of this story.
Don't tell my parents it's just a drug and suicide story.
Yeah, just say that you found me and
tell them I'm an eighth level halfling bard.
All of these stories make it seem like James Dallas Egbert is also very charismatic, because how do you convince... it's the number one story in the country and you've got three friends hiding you in East Lansing and nobody lets on? And then he convinces the detective not to tell the story.
Well, maybe he's convincing the detective to tell a more interesting story, you know, like stick with the Donahue stuff.
Right. You found me. Okay. Wink, wink. Deere does keep Egbert's confidence. And unfortunately, Egbert remains a very like sad and...
that was not the end of his troubled
No, you know, he ended up less than a year later actually succeeding in killing himself with a gun.
Oh.
But Deere continues to keep his secret. So as this is all going on, as it's a kind of a major event in the culture, an author by the name of Rona Jaffe, sees the moment, seizes the opportunity, and very quickly writes a book called Mazes and Monsters, which came out in 1981.
It's fiction, or?
It's fiction. A complete, you know, it's just a pulp novel. And you know, Rona, you know, like basically jotted it down, partly in fear that she was going to get, you know, that somebody else was
scooped, there, right?
Yeah, if you're
writing a quickie bestseller.
There were probably 50 people writing Mazes and Monsters at the time, and hers was the first to market, and it was kind of a minor hit. And in 1982, a film a TV movie, Mazes and Monsters, came out. It was the first starring role of Tom Hanks. Have you seen Mazes and Monsters?
I have not. I think it's, you can now get it on DVD and Blu-ray, and it's got the kind of the ironic reefer madness appeal.
Yeah, I highly recommend it. It's hilarious, and it posits this world that gifted college students are dressing up in robes with swords and going down into steam tunnels and caverns and playing real Dungeons and Dragons with real consequences.
Does any of this, I mean, does it insulate the game from it that, like, they're not playing D&D, they're playing a crazy, weird D&D, or does backlash start to hit Gygax's growing empire?
Well, so Gygax's growing empire isn't affected in any way by this, except that it quadruples in profitability.
It's just publicity.
By the end of 1980. And it becomes a kind of now generally accepted cultural understanding that this is really happening. And I remember it very distinctly. In 1980, I was in seventh grade. I was reading The Hobbit and playing Dungeons and Dragons. And it was on everybody's lips. It was in everyone's mind that that in playing Dungeons and Dragons as a young person, there was every possibility that you would disappear into a steam tunnel and get addicted to.
But was it like heavy metal, where that was actually a feature, not a bug, for the kids who were getting into it?
It certainly was interesting to me, and I remember kind of trying to gin up in myself enough interest in the fantasy world that I could even begin to consider playing it for real. And I really did. I remember on my long walks home from seventh grade, because when I was in seventh grade, I had to walk 2 miles uphill in the snow both ways to school.
The Alaska way.
Kind of picturing supernatural enemies and fighting them with my flaming sword. Kind of was working on, like, maybe I can do magic, you know, maybe I can conjure an orb with my hands.
It does work.
And I was
just stick to being a level 8 barbarian or whatever.
I was not able to conjure an orb, and I was not able to get enough going on. I'm imaginative, but I could not care enough to really start. Well, there are no steam tunnels in Alaska, and any tunnels would be very cold and damp. But, you know, it didn't catch. Right. But it was kind of in Time magazine. It was a plausible sort of.
So if there were people doing this, it was in backlash to the alarmism. It was, you know, it may have motivated more people to start fooling around with this stuff than ever would have otherwise.
Oh, for sure. It's the Streisand effect, yeah, where, you know, she says, don't take a picture of my house, and then everybody on the internet has a picture of her house. The fear around Dungeons and Dragons started to become kind of feverish. And, you know, particularly when Egbert killed himself.
He's back in the Netherlands.
And Deer hasn't revealed the secret that he promised Egbert he wouldn't tell. But in 1984, Deer feels like his responsibility to keep the secret has gone to the grave with Egbert, and he writes a book called The Dungeon Master, where he kind of comes correct on the whole issue and says that in fact Egbert was just a depressed kid. There doesn't seem to be any evidence for this, you know, the truth of this world that he was partly responsible for creating, that Deer was responsible for creating, and tries to debunk it. But like a lot of the attempts to debunk cults and whatnot, it doesn't gain any traction. People really like the idea, and it begins to be a thing in law enforcement where,
as we've seen recently,
cops are
very susceptible to this kind of
The least culpable and most science-based arm of the world.
I just saw a mimeograph cops thing in my church foyer.
So Moral Majority and the jack chicks of the world start to reach out to law enforcement and to legislators saying, this is a real threat. The Satanists are here.
What's a candidate going to do if asked, what are you going to do about demon summoning in your district?
Yeah.
You're not going to say you're for it.
Yeah, no, of course not. I mean, how long have you supported the demons, right? And T. teenagers and heavy metal iconography puts Satanism right in everybody's lap. As you mentioned, AC/DC uses a lot of that iconography. Led Zeppelin, throughout their whole history, had a kind of
Norse magical
thing. Well, that and also Aleister Crowley, yeah. The kind of rehabilitation of all this stuff. And then, I mean, Rush 2112 has a pentagram.
Yeah, let's blame Prague.
It's all Rush's fault. So if you're looking for evidence that there is a global Satanist conspiracy to get young people into a cult, a blood cult, you can find the evidence everywhere. And a lot of it is tongue-in-cheek fun.
Yeah, wasn't TSR kind of trolling too?
Like, absolutely.
I feel like the game at this time was full of demons. Like, when did Fiend Folio come out? Like, TSR is really playing up the demonology of their own game, even as this moral panic begins.
They're super into it. And, you know, and Gary Gygax is a nut and a high roller and kind of a bad businessman. And he's not, you know, he doesn't feel like this moral panic is anything other than hilarious. But then it gets real, because a young man by the name of Irving Pulling commits suicide and is known to be a Dungeons and Dragons player. And his mother, Patricia Pulling, blames at first the principal of his high school, a man by the name of Robert Bracey III, giving some credence to my theory that...
Yeah, this is like the middle name Wayne of...
There shouldn't be thirds. You just... Your grandfather dies and you become the second.
If you get your wish, you're going to have a different co-host.
She sued the principal and claimed that the principal had put a D&D curse on Irving.
Whoa. The principal... So it's not just the principal, but he had a... The principal had...
The principal introduced...
Had satanic majesties requesting.
Yeah, introduced Irving to Dungeons and Dragons.
Do you think that was true? Was he a hip principal who was like telling the kids about the cool gaming stuff?
Almost certainly, right? He Robert Bracey was just, yeah, your groovy guy who was like, you know what, awkward kids, why don't you meet me in the lunchroom?
Here's something you don't know. I mean, I'm also the level 12 cleric Grimgar.
Exactly. So Patricia Pulling becomes convinced that Irving died as a result of his Dungeons and Dragons activities. And law enforcement at this point is primed for this to be true. And partly because, yeah, there's a lot of evangelical Christianity, like law enforcement overlap. Yeah. But there's also, you know, this is an opportunity to kind of make good on all of the serial killers that they didn't find throughout the 70s and all of the Manson, you know.
How exciting to, if one of these kind of boring suburban crimes actually does turn out to be some kind of a devilish crime ring of some kind.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know, Manson's in Hollywood Hills, but this is, you know, East Lansing, Michigan. How fun, or in the case of Patricia Pulling, Richmond, Virginia.
So it's borderline South.
Yeah, it gives the cops something to get excited about. And she goes on 60 Minutes, and Ed Bradley.
Come on, Ed Bradley. I expect better of early 80s 60 Minutes.
Yeah, you would, right? But if this is, you know, it's part of the kind of Bigfoot UFO fallout. Like, any of this seems possible, and the media really does.
People don't forget when you jump on the thing that turns out to be bogus. Yeah. Like, all the people writing today about Havana Syndrome are never going to be held accountable for the dumb things they thought. Like, you just want to jump on in case it does turn out to be the next big fear.
Yeah,
you want to scare people first.
As someone who used to believe in the media as the not the fourth estate, but the...
I used to believe in Ed Bradley in particular.
For sure, 60 Minutes. But a lot of the criticism of media, of sensationalist media in the 80s and 90s, a lot of that criticism holds water. This was a ratings boom, and it really made Patricia Pulling into a national media star. Mm. And she ends up getting her private investigator's license and writes a book called The Devil's Web, Who is Stalking Your Children for Satan?
I mean, I would like to know who is stalking my children for Satan. I'd buy the book just to find out, even if it turns out to be the answer to be no one.
So she ends up becoming a law enforcement resource. And this this becomes a very profitable side gig for a whole lot of kind of kooks who advertise themselves as Satan experts, Dungeons and Dragons experts, and they make all kinds of videos and do training sessions with law enforcement to recognize when it's a spray painted star and when it's a spray painted pentagram. Mm. And so Patricia Pulling forms an advocacy group, a political action committee, and I think she might have chosen the acronym first, BAD, B-A-D-D, and then filled in the words, bothered about Dungeons and Dragons.
Considering that her son is dead, I feel like she should be more than bothered.
Yeah, bothered seems a little bit tame, right?
It does seem like she, you know, she's a little bit irritated about Dungeons and Dragons.
She could have called it Dad, disgusted about Dungeons and Dragons.
I assume this postdates the idea of parental advocacy groups like MAD, Mothers Against Drunk Driving. That's, 1980.
Right.
So she's following in the footsteps of these other kinds of PTA-friendly organizations, which gives her some legitimacy.
Yeah, she could have. It could have been SAD, sick about Dungeons and Dragons. That seems better. Was there a SAD later?
Students
against drunk drivers. Right. Yeah. She could have gotten in on the ground floor of that. So right about that time, sort of by the late 80s, it had become a like a cultural truism that Satanists had infected the globe. And there are a lot of victims of the satanic panic that could also be their own omnibus entries. The West Memphis Three get convicted of satanic murder because they were a bunch of dopey goths.
Yeah.
The McMartin preschool Satan trial, which ended up being the largest, longest, and most expensive trial in California history. The belief that they had also dug tunnels under their preschool and were...
It's always tunnels. It's right back to the Hillary Clinton's pizza joint.
They were charged with 321 tunnels. Counts of childhood ritual abuse.
Don't these people know there's no basement in the Alamo?
The Pizzagate with Hillary Clinton, Amanda Knox's prosecution. There are actually... like a whole lot of people still in prison with life sentences for convictions of ritual murder for which there is no evidence of any kind, except that they were goths or weird, or, I mean, a lot of it was just cop hysteria.
I mean, that's the thing. We should not be surprised that there's, a disproportionate number of troubled teens or teen suicides where, you know, there's certain genres of music or certain hobbies that they have in common, because it's a matter of correlation, not causation. You know, your kid was a misfit and a loner, and that's why they listened to this music, and that's why they played D&D instead of being on the lacrosse team. And so a higher than average number of law enforcement will find a higher than average number of kids who,
sure,
who played D&D, and it's the other way around. They were troubled and then they played D&D. They didn't get troubled because they played D&D.
And that continued into modern times, right? Soundgarden, all their music was, it sounded like Led Zeppelin, but it was about
spooky
drugs and suicide. And then, contemporary music in the metal genre still, if you looked at my own record collection and judged that every album that had satanic imagery or people wearing scary makeup.
Yeah.
That's like 80% of the music I have, including all the 50s jazz.
It's all your Alice Cooper and your 50s jazz. And it wasn't a ploy. I mean, when you look at the history of these groups, there's a lot of drugs and suicide.
Sure.
Like they were reacting to this. They were, propagating the aesthetic they reacted to.
In 1988, a man by the name of Leith Van Stein was brutally murdered and his wife brutally injured in their home. And it quickly kind of came out that his stepson, Chris Pritchard, had enlisted two of his college friends to murder his stepfather for his $2 million estate. And in the investigation around the murders, his two accomplices and he were all convicted of conspiracy to murder in the case of one of them who did the actual deed, murder. But it came out at trial that they were all Dungeons & Dragons players, and that the murder, although clearly was a murder
for profit,
got tied up in this idea that they were...
Did they discuss it in terms of a campaign that, and character names?
Yeah, this was part of the hullabaloo around the trial that they were, and it came at a perfect moment in the culture. 1988, we're looking for Satan murders. There's remarkably few. There's a
deplorable dearth of Satan murders, and considering the massive Satan murder industry.
Here's a great Satan murder, and it spawns two different books, one by Joe McGinnis, Cruel Doubt, and one by Jerry Bledsoe, Blood Games, both of which really hype the Satan murder aspect, going so far as to take images from TSR monster manuals and doctoring them in the books to, you know, kind of point more toward the style of murder of von Stein, and, you know, like really making the case that this was a satanic murder, although there's zero evidence that it was.
If I remember right, my parents were kind of susceptible to this. Like when my brother got really into, you know, D&D in middle and high school, even though they had, you know, kind of fooled around with the early fantasy role-playing box games around 1980, my parents were still like, now, which of these D&D books are you buying? Does that one have any of the devils in it? My brother listens to the show. I'm sure he can clarify whether, but that's my memory, that they were still like, oh, I don't know.
Well, interestingly, TSR finally responded to this. It was directing so much attention at Dungeons & Dragons that in the second edition of Dungeons & Dragons that came out in 1989, they removed the words demon and devil from all of the books. So they renamed devils and demons, and they gave them, devils became Batazu.
Batazu?
Batazu.
Well, that seems even more
it does,
alarming.
Right? And demons were now renamed Tanari.
I'm sure these are just like Arabic or Persian terms for like
devils and demons.
Like, this seems like exactly what Satan would do. He would want, you know, the greatest trick he ever pulled was convincing suburban teens that he didn't exist. And that's right. Instead he was a Ba'atu or something.
But TSR was, I think that there's a kind of story about at the time TSR had a single receptionist, a woman who spent a lot of the 80s answering the phone and explaining to panicked reporters who were on deadline that there was no satanic ritual abuse in Dungeons & Dragons.
Is there ever immediate pushback? Like, does the tide ever turn?
Only much later. Michael Stackpole, the kind of famous geek culture writer and creator, writes an article called Game Hysteria and Truth, partly responding to Patricia Pulling. Did you have something to say about Stackpole?
No, I was just looking him up.
Oh.
He's a role-playing guy.
Yeah.
Battletech books.
Yeah. Stackpole wrote the Battletech books. He's a legendary character in the scene. And then he published a book called The Pulling Report in 1990 that basically tried to disabuse the world of all of the efforts of bad.
But that stuff never works.
It didn't work, and Patricia Pulling continued to have a role, you know, continued to profit from her. And, you know, she's a grieving mother, but bad became a profitable enterprise in advising police departments and ministers about what to do to combat your local Dungeons & Dragons Satanists. And that lasted until she died of cancer in 1997. It was not until, I mean, the satanic panic lasted all through the 90s and into the 2000s. I mean, you think about Amanda Knox, and continues to this day in the form of the conspiracy theories about the Democrats eating babies and all the QAnon stuff.
They've got their secret satanic reason. Now it's powered by kind of a alternate media and social media technology, which really turns out is much more efficient than, you know, mimeographed pamphlets on a church billboard. Like, you know, we're at the point where the 25% of America who believes in this stuff can now find each other and form a voting bloc.
And what's interesting is that only now, and by that I mean just in the last year or two, is the media, the thinking class, reviewing the satanic panics of the 80s and 90s as a way of trying to understand. There are all these retrospective articles now that are, you know, kind of looking back at this as a cultural phenomenon and kind of acknowledging, I mean, the media never acknowledges its own complicity, but acknowledging the complicity of earlier media, right? Vox is outing 60 Minutes and BuzzFeed or Wired.
Take
or,
that, you know, Phil Donahue.
That's right. And it's, you know, it's now again kind of a, there's finally a recognition that after 1992, there was like the panic, the moral panic all started to focus on video games, and there was not a single sort of Dungeons and Dragons related Satan case.
They went underground.
Like they, yeah, well, right. That's the greatest trick that Satan ever pulled.
Well, I'm kind of wondering if it's going to be, you know, if you look at the ritual hysteria around Halloween trick-or-treat poisoning, for example,
right,
you'll find that the only documented cases are people who were aware of the cases that were inspired by the actual fake hysteria. You know, yeah. like I guess I think we're lucky that there were no like actual D&D killings that were brought about by people who were convinced that D&D killing was a thing.
Yeah,
it's, you know, troubled teens who are like, oh, I guess we're supposed to murder old man Johnson now.
It's very interesting, especially in terms of gaming, that you know, there's a lot of pushback about whether or not violent video games and violent films, create an atmosphere or the conditions where violence and mass violence is acceptable. And there's a tremendous pushback to that notion.
Right. And I think that's because there is some research suggesting in many cases it's like a healthy outlet for these feelings that kids are going to have anyway. Right?
Yeah, and that's the argument the Juggalos use too. but also, you know, like a lot of the research that goes into it, it's impossible to determine. You know, when two teenagers shoot up their high school,
I just want a double blind test where I take 100 kids from the same suburb and I make 50 of them play advanced D&D 6 hours a day. And then you see, like, you know, how many of them end up doing ritual murders.
In the 90s, Wizards of the Coast, again, a Seattle right. company, bought TSR. And by the third edition, they started to put demons and devils back in it.
Ah, Satan had a long con here.
He did. There have been a couple further editions with a lot of real doubling down on Satans and demons. There are a lot of, there's just
if
like,
we survived the 80s, if we survived Oprah, we can survive anything.
The Wizards of the Coast started putting some heavy, like, adults only demon themes into D&D.
We're creating a new satanic panic by recording this show.
Well, what's interesting is that currently, there is a lot of controversy around Dungeons & Dragons from within the gaming community, not because of the demonology, which now is like a huge part of the literature around the game. Devils and demons have sex in each other and murdering. The current controversy is that Dungeons & Dragons is not inclusive or diverse enough. And that there are a lot of racial stereotypes in orcs and portrayals of Asians and so forth.
Interesting.
And so there's a revised fifth edition of Dungeons and Dragons coming out that hopefully now or that they're rewriting in response to criticism that they aren't inclusive.
I mean, it makes sense. Again, this is just correlation, but the kind of audience that's going to want to play these things is more likely than their peers to be queer, to be disabled, to be neurodiverse. I mean,
to be
out of place minorities and in any regard.
Right. And ritual murderers.
You mentioned that Patricia Pulling died in the late 90s. She is, she died of lung cancer in 1997.
Yeah.
And this is speculation, but if she has the same story of most of the people who died of lung cancer in the 90s. She really should have been spending the 80s fighting against cigarette smoking than fantasy role-playing games.
Yeah. Right?
Like one of those had a bigger body count by millions.
Although eliminating cigarette smoking, as we've mostly done, has not eliminated cancer.
It led to vaping. That's the real problem. And that concludes Bothered About Dungeons & Dragons, entry 145.1T0515, certificate number 38501, in the Omnibus. Futurelings, before social media was used to overthrow the American government, it was just like kind of a fun place to chill. In that era, we were at Omnibus Project, in my case, at Ken Jennings. You can find at John Roderick around somewhere, mostly Patreon.
Sure, look for me there.
Back in the day. You could email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com with tell us all your D&D stories. We didn't really get into a lot of lore, you know. We want to hear about your characters and your campaign and your experience points and all of that.
Yeah, just write kenjennings@gmail.com.
Yeah, and tell me about the craziest saving throw you ever rolled, and then I puts the word saving throw in the subject line, so I will know to delete all these.
So you can search.
So I can search and find them more quickly. You can mail us physical items. What's in the mailbag today? I can tell this is our Portland friend David Chelsea because of the beautiful. I know the show is long, but I'm going to open this quickly.
Don't open it quickly because you need to preserve the painting. First of all, hold it up so I can see it.
I should have done this Tuesday when the Phantom was short.
Can I see the? It's upside down, you ding dong. Oh, it's Silva.
It's the Guardian Angels.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Subject.
That is God, he's such a good painter.
David says his wife and I just flew to Boston.
His wife and you just flew to Boston? Yeah,
What a terrible way for him to find out
that story.
No, this was their first time flying in the pandemic.
Oh.
So he was crammed into a tiny seat for the first time, listened to Omnibus, and did some sketches in real time on airline discomfort bags.
Barf bags.
Of the content of the shows he was listening to, which was The Eerie War and The Town of Bent Necks, both John Roderick shows.
Oh.
One is from
good choice.
One is from the Portland to Boston flight. One is on the Boston to Portland return. These are just fantastic. I'm going to pass these over to you since they were your shirts, but we'll
give me that envelope too.
These are beautiful. And we'll put links to these on the Patreon so that if you subscribe at whatever level that is, you can see these beautiful, beautiful barf bags. Man,
hot damn.
These are pop art, just like the shields of Papua New Guinea.
And somehow he manages to convey the kind of crazy leaping around of the episodes.
Yeah.
Somehow.
It would be hard to reconstruct that this was an actual, you would not believe this was an actual podcast if you just saw it in comic strip form.
Yeah. We have here on the Town of Bent Necks, there's Spike Lee, there's Franconia, there's Cobbling, there's the Nuremberg Trials, Abercrombie and Fitch.
Spike Lee, the Nuremberg Trials, and Abercrombie and Fitch do not come up on most, most Joe Rogan shows, for example, most Radio Labs. Please send us comic strip adaptations of every omnibus. We would love to have you sign over rights to that, and we would love to publish them and make money off of them.
I'm gonna have him do the art for the next album I make.
It's pretty great stuff. Yes. Thank you, David. Check out David Chelsea's work online if you wanna see what's for sale. You can support the show more materially at patreon.com/omnibusproject. Or otherwise you won't be able to see David's cool art. In fact, at one of the highest levels of Patreon donation, you can even suggest a topic for the show. And today's show about Dungeons & Dragons was suggested by Jeff, who was also hoping we would do a show about penny farthing bicycles. But instead, we chose D&D. Sorry, Jeff, and penny farthing bicycle fans.
Thanks, Jeff.
You can find like-minded listeners by searching for Futurelings on Facebook and Reddit and Discord and the like. And I think that's it. I think we're done with this very long show.
Not yet.
Are you going to do a very slow outro?
Futurelings.
From
our vantage point.
I'm going to add the theremin in case you're listening to the super deluxe version that doesn't have it.
In your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come. But if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may have been our final word.
Now let's just have a 20-minute pause to make this the longest entry ever.
I'm really giving people their money's worth for the ASMR here. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.